This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. We've all been there. You're in the middle of a test. It's a final, something important. And then you get stumped by that one question. You just know. You know the answer to it, but you just can't reach it in your brain, right? So you think, and you think a little harder. You twirl your pencil. You stare at the paper. You tap your book. You read the question again. Nothing happens. And then ding, ding, ding. Test is over. Pencil's down. You walk outside into the sunshine and bam! Oh yeah, that was the answer. Why it was so obvious? Why didn't I remember that? Well, why does it happen? What's going on in your brain that when you're focused and you need the answer, you don't have a clue? And as soon as you relax, bingo, there it is. Oh, I should have known that. My next guests reveal a few of the secrets of learning and recalling information in their new books, and they have a few study tips, too, that are just really just in time for all you students back in school, and some of the suggestions are surprising. We're going to talk about it. Barbara Oakley is the author of A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Science Even If You Flunked Algebra. How many? Yeah, raise your hands. Yeah. She's also a professor of engineering at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. She joins us here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's nice to be here, Ira.
Thank you. Nice to have you. Benedict Carey is the author of How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. He's also a science reporter at the New York Times. He's also here in our New York studios. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks, Ira.
Barbara, you write in your book that it's possible to be too focused on a problem so that you miss the answer might be right in front of you.
Absolutely. Well, part of the problem is when you're focusing on something, you're actually blocking the neural networks that you might need to be able to actually answer that problem. Turns out we have two very different neural states. One is what we use when we're focusing, and the other is a set of diffuse neural resting states. So when you're focusing, you're actually blocking your access to those neural resting states.
Mm-hmm. So is it better to then take a break? You know, I used to talk to students of Albert Einstein years ago, and they used to say, when Einstein had a problem, he'd say, I give a little tink, and he'd go away and take a walk, you know, think about it. Maybe he's doing what you're saying. Don't focus too much on it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Just take a little break. And that's what people like Thomas Edison or surrealist painter Salvador Dali used to do as well. They'd relax a little bit, and Dali used to call it sleeping without sleeping. He'd sit with keys in his hand, and then when he was trying to figure out a problem, he'd relax and relax, and when he'd relax so much he'd fall asleep, the keys would fall, wake him up, and then he'd have these new ideas, creative approaches. And this is what Edison did with ball bearings.
Huh, taking a little break. Ben, you have an interesting analogy in your book where you compare the parts of a brain to a movie production crew.
The brain's a storyteller, really. The conscious brain's a storyteller, and it's storytelling all the time, including when you're studying and when you're practicing, and is sort of integrating the environment as you go along. And so recreating some of those cues allows you to remember some, you know, the things that you're studying, and particularly when you change your locations and you change the environment. You're enriching those memories. You're enriching the story in a way. It allows you to retrieve the stuff later on when you need it during an exam, for example.
You say forgetting is hugely important to learning, but it sounds counterintuitive.
We all think of forgetting as the enemy, right? Like it's a thief sort of lurking there to take away our knowledge. And you know, it can be ominous when you can't remember something. You can't remember a friend's birthday or you blank out during an exam. But forgetting is hugely important to learning. It's really learning's best friend in a way. We touched on it just a little bit with Barbara there, in that, or your example with the question that you can't get on the exam.
Right.
Part of what's happening there is that forgetting should act like a filter, allowing you to see clearly what you need to solve the problem. Because all of your memories are intertwined in these huge, complicated networks. So it acts, in one way, as a sophisticated spam filter. It also acts as kind of in the same way that muscle breakdown does. So that, for example, once you remember the answer to that question later as you're walking back home, sort of kicking yourself,
right,
it's much more ingrained, because that increment of forgetting that happened allows, in a way that sort of muscle breakdown allows greater muscle to build, The next time you revisit it, it becomes much more ingrained in memory. So those are two ways that forgetting is really an ally of memory.
Our number 844-724-8255 if you would like to get in on the conversation about memory techniques. One interesting point that both of you sort of touch on in your books, and I'll ask this, Barbara, first, is to repeat things. You know, make flashcards. If you have to memorize the Gettysburg Address, right, you should test yourself as you incrementally go along or hear yourself saying it.
Absolutely. What that does is think of practicing a piece of music.
Yeah.
You would never play a song once and say, hey, look, I've got it, right? You need to practice and repeat in order for it to become sort of one connected neural chunk. And that's actually the same thing you want to do with math homework, for example. You want to not just do a math problem once. You want to bring it up and repeat it until it flows like a song from your mind. Then you've really got it.
Mm-hmm. But also you talk about getting away from the problem. Get yourself out of that room or away from the book or Benedict, you know, and don't sit there hour after hour.
Right. I mean, that's right. That they call this incubation, a great word for it, which means, you know, you're stuck. So, you know, these are the research on this is just fantastic. You know, all these sort of puzzles that you try to have to solve and you know, you get blocked because your assumptions are mistaken. And, you know, we've all done this in looking at, you know, various jokes and puzzles. And, you know, you can't get away from them. You're blocked. You run out of ideas. And at that point, you need to step away and do something else is beneficial because the brain continues to kind of work on the problem offline. You can be off jogging or, you know, playing a video game or, you know, having a cup of tea or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it lets go of those initial assumptions. It gives you a little better chance when you come back.
Yeah, I noticed that when I do a crossword puzzle. I can't get this word. I just, you know, a day later, I come back and say, oh, there was the answer. Right?
There was.
But the key to that is you slept on it. My colleague at UC San Diego is Terry Sanowski, the Francis Crick professor at the Salk Institute. This guy, he's one of only 10 living human beings who's simultaneously a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Engineering, and the National Institutes of Medicine. And what Terry says he likes to point to is when you go to sleep at night, new synoptic connections arise. Mm-hmm. So it's as if you go to sleep with one brain and then you wake up with an upgrade in the morning. And that's actually what's happening when you sleep.
We've talked over the years with Robert Stickgold, and he has talked about, he studies sleep and learning. And he says you need if you don't get 6 hours, you have to exactly what you're saying, you have to have a minimum of 6 or 7 hours or else you're not going to cement in.
It's exactly right. And sleep does more than that, too. During sleep, your brain cells actually shrink, and that allows fluids to wash the metabolic toxins that have risen during the day. It allows it to wash them away. And then when you wake up in the morning, you've got a fresh mind. So don't sleep don't go without sleep before a test because you're taking a test with a poisoned brain.
Mm. What is the Einstelling effect?
Oh, that's a really important effect. And that is when you have neuroscientific or sort of neurological patterns already embedded in your mind. In other words, you've already got something in mind that you're thinking of. It can block your ability to see other approaches to a problem or even proper approaches to a problem. So it's very important sometimes to step away so that you have that chance to look in a new way and develop different patterns, different neural patterns to examine the problem.
Let's go to the phones. Our number 844-724-8255. Let's go to Utah with Justin. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you very much. I would actually like to know if the guest can comment on why, for example, for me, it's easier to remember words and vocabulary and foreign languages versus numbers and formulas and things like that.
I think, you know, they're all individual differences in our memories, and we sort of discover those as we go ahead learning. This has been Carrie talking. That's sort of what you got to work with. And so the idea is to sort of learn techniques that will build memories across the board. And what cognitive scientists have learned in studying learning is that you know, a lot of our ideas of what learning and memory are built into sort of modern ideas of education, you know, homework and practice and classes and so on. But in fact, the brain is really learned to learn through evolution, but, you know, piecemeal, picking up things here and there, you know, and, you know, in any weather and all sorts of environments. And so once you kind of see that the brain is learning all the time, you can then start to use techniques like spaced study, for example, or mixed or interleave study. We can talk about those to improve memory for any of these things that you feel, you know, you're weak in.
Let's talk about thanks for calling. Let's talk about interleave study. What is that?
Well, interleave study is mixing usually related material, like different problems in math, trigonometry, algebra, calculus, things that wouldn't be a part of, you know, a normal homework assignment, which is usually concentrated on one particular skill. But this kind of goes across the board. I mean, when you're a kid, I think all of us at one point or another thought, well, you know, I want to be the best, the guy who can dribble the ball behind my back the very best. Or, you know, I want to be the best skateboarder. You know, you come up with one move, one thing you think is going to make you sort of famous on your block, and you're practicing it over and over and over and over, and then some kid swings by and he's doing it with a blindfold on, practically, right?
Right. I had those kids. Yeah. My roommate could do that. I couldn't do that.
Well, the idea is that by practicing mixed skills, whether it's skateboarding or basketball or math, you're building a general agility in those things that sharpens each one faster than you would if you practice them in blocks. So that's the idea of interleaving.
Well, just going back for a bit, that the listener's question was really a good one. I mean, for me, I originally just loved language and culture, and that's all I wanted to learn.
How'd you get into math, to study math?
Well, what's funny is I flunked my way through elementary, middle, and high school math and science, and I didn't start studying those subjects until I was 26. So it is very possible to also excel at math and science. I mean, I'm a professor now of engineering. Who could have ever guessed? But if you apply some of the same approaches that you use for language to learning math and science, chunking those ideas and repeating and growing with them, you can actually excel in both types of disciplines.
You also write about, and I find this to be true, getting out of of your typical study area into another place, right? The professor, you know, I was thinking going outside into the courtyard. Robin Williams in that movie where he played the English teacher, he took all his kids outside. They did other things to learn the poetry better.
Oh, absolutely. It really helps to... One thing that I like to say, though, is, and it's related to this idea, and that is just that the idea of following your passion is a really good one, but also a really dangerous idea, because a lot of times your passion develops about something you're really good at. But some things, like math and science, for some people, take longer to get good at. So that's why I say, don't just follow your passions. Broaden your passions.
Mm-hmm. You know, let me just, I'm sorry.
Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Ben Carey, author of How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. Barbara Oakley, author of A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even if you flunked algebra. 844-724-8255 is our number. Ben didn't mean to rudely interrupt.
Oh, that's all right. No, I just wanted to add to Barbara's point there about, or your question about moving around. You know, one of the things we just sort of believe, we feel self-evident, is restlessness is bad for learning, right? You know, well, these kids with ADHD and so on, they're moving around. I'm as restless as it comes. You know, I'm up and down all the time. I can't sit still for more than 15 minutes. And in my job at the New York Times, I'm having to learn new and difficult stuff constantly, and I'm in motion. I'm talking to people. I'm up and down, looking on the computer, walking around, sort of interrupting myself. And it makes the whole thing not only better, because you're allowing the sort of the brain to pick up the information in all sorts of different environments, but it's a whole lot more fun. I mean, you can use this for kids, especially. You can use this in your favor, essentially, to get them to keep working.
I'm a pacer. I can get up and walk the floor. I learned that from Ed Edelson, used to be at the Daily News, one of my mentors.
There you go. Yeah.
He's the pace, and I said, geez, something wrong with that, and I picked it up. Yes.
So pacing and exercise, as it turns out, that exercise of all sorts is really valuable. It is one of the few activities that allows the new neurons that are being born every day in your hippocampus to grow and survive. And so exercise is actually one of the best drugs available, legal or illegal, on the market to help you to learn and remember better.
And now that we know that you shouldn't be sitting at your desk for any length of time, right? You should be standing or walking.
Bingo.
should we worry about multitasking?
That's a question about distraction, and I think that's a sort of the worry du jour right now, that distraction is sort of ruining our kids' education and it's somehow changing their brain and so on. In fact, distraction can help. We've already talked about this earlier in the program. Of course, it's bad if you need continuous attention, like if you're driving or you're listening to a lecture or something. But in these problem-solving situations, particularly when you're stuck, distraction is the best way to get unstuck.
But should you be tweeting and doing your homework?
Well, no. If you're tweeting and you're on Instagram the whole time, right, then you're not studying at all, right? So we got to. So
there's a limit.
There is a limit. Yeah.
Now, Barbara, you have one.
Yeah, the main thing is research is beginning to show. We used to think that there were seven items or seven slots in working memory, and now it turns out there's more like four, which is more attuned with my way of thinking because I know I can't hold seven things in memory very easily. But anyway, with four slots in working memory, if you are slightly focused on something else, what that's really doing is, in some sense, taking up one or more of those slots in working memory. And so whatever working memory smarts you have is being diminished because you're allowing some of your attention to be dissipated.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's quite interesting. I don't know. Maybe I'm always three slots full. I'm talking with Barbara Oakley, author of A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. Also, Ben Carey, author of How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. He's also a science reporter for the New York Times. We're going to take a break. Give us a call. We're talking more about how we do all that stuff. 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about how the brain soaks up information and how you can make best use of that with my guest, Barbara Oakley, author of A Mind for Numbers, and professor of engineering at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. Ben Carey, author of How We Learn and a science reporter at the New York Times. I'd like to bring on another guest now who is a professor of engineering, and she doesn't use the typical soldering irons and circuit boards to teach, though, but something a little less traditional and more playful. She uses Play-Doh. Anne Marie Thomas is an associate professor of engineering at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, author of the forthcoming book, Making Makers, Kids, Tools, and the Future of Innovation. She's also the co-creator of Squishy Circuits. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
What are squishy circuits?
What are squishy circuits? Well, they are a way of sculpting working electrical circuits out of homemade Play-Doh.
You make it yourself, the Play-Doh.
You make it yourself. Things you could find in the grocery store.
How do you make the Play-Doh?
How do you make it? I had my research students and I told them we had to look at the literature to do this. So we took out very serious scientific literature, like 1001 fun things to do with your toddler on a rainy day. And we tested many, many Play-Doh recipes. And we have two recipes. One which conducts electricity quite well, and it's a very salty Play-Doh. And then we actually have one that is thousands of times more resistant, and it's a sugary Play-Doh. And so when you combine these, you actually then have conductors and insulators, like wires and insulators, and you can start sculpting working electrical circuits.
So you stick little things into the Play-Doh, little wires, and the Play-Doh is the wires.
Play-Doh is the wire. You can stick in some lights, or you can stick in some motors, or we can stick in some loud buzzers.
Hmm. Is this enough to teach the concepts to the kids? Do they get it this way?
You know, I'll be honest. I started this. I'm an engineering professor with a background in robotics. I started this project because I wanted my own little kids, who were under two at the time, to be able to play with electricity. There really wasn't a way for them to do that in a way that little hands could do it. You're right. A soldering iron isn't something I'm going to hand my three-year-old. And I was shocked at how quickly they could pick up the idea and share with each other how to get the lights to light up and to learn things like the fact that an LED light is directional and only works in one direction. So we started with playing and then realized quite quickly that the kids were doing a lot more learning than we had originally anticipated.
Do you find the kids today welcome this stuff because they're spending so much time on their little portable devices with just moving their thumbs around that they welcome actual hands-on activities like this?
We've definitely found that. We bring this all over the country and the world in terms of libraries and fairs, and kids never pause before jumping in and starting to play. They don't even ask us how it works. They don't really care. They figure it out pretty quickly. It's often the adults who are a little more hesitant to get their hands dirty.
Mm-hmm. You've also taught a class about dynamics by having your students participate in circus activities. Is that right?
That is true.
Tell us about that.
As your previous guest said, we learn quite well when we're moving. And I was an amateur flying trapeze and static trapeze student and realized that that really felt like a giant physics playground. In high school, you're used to pushing a little pendulum back and forth or stretching out a spring to learn harmonic oscillation. And I convinced the university safety office to let me put my engineers on flying trapeze wearing sensors to be the pendulums themselves and jump off of 40-foot-high bungee trapezes to be their own harmonic oscillators.
Wow, I'm just trying to picture all of that. I'm taking me a little time to put that in my brain there. No person was injured during the making of that.
No one was injured in the making of that course.
Have you seen squishy circuits and play help your students really understand and retain more information than they would in a typical textbook experience?
I definitely think so. And I also realize that they are so much more engaged. I joke about that circus class. I could have had them doing it was Lagrangian dynamics and the equations of motions. I could have given them standard book homeworks. And instead, 3 days a week, we trucked off to circus school together. And they would come in on the weekends and analyze their data. And they ended up doing so much more work than they even had to because they cared. They were laughing. They'd order pizza and start analyzing, Sarah and the flying trapeze.
Barbara Oakley is shaking. She's another engineer. She's shaking her head at all of this. Could have done this.
This is so brilliant. I love hearing this. There's such a rich tradition in science of people getting inside of what they're trying to learn about or what they're trying to do discoveries about. And this is a perfect example of that.
So where, Anne-Marie, do you take this next? Do you go past Play-Doh, and can you incorporate the circus together with the Play-Doh somehow?
I lead a research lab of undergraduates we call the Playful Learning Lab, and the whole idea is to play and to be curious and, never know exactly where these projects are going. We teach Play-Doh circuitry and sewing circuitry at a local deaf school in sign language, and I have other students who have a little cooking lab set up in the basement, and they're investigating molecular gastronomy. To us, it's all play. And really using that lens of we don't know all the answers, but we're going to be curious, we're going to play, we'll try some things. And it's not something to be scared of. I spend a lot of time teaching teachers and parents about engineering. And right. When you start looking at it as something that you're physically engaged in, and you can't really get wrong. You can learn it. We're not going to grade you when you're making your circuit about whether it works or not.
Yeah, what is the role? Let me ask all my guests. What is the role of play in learning? I mean, playfulness, it really does help people learn.
Absolutely, playful experience.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Ben?
Yeah, well, I mean, we play by nature, and it's a way of doing our experimenting from an early age, and it's sort of learn things by messing up and by trying new things and so on. And also, I mean, part of what she's doing here, I think, is just giving, extra dimension to all of these subjects. I mean, each time you change the way you engage it, you are enriching the experience. You can read it in the book, and you can play with it, with the Play-Doh and so on. It just keeps adding dimension.
Right. And Anne-Marie, with the playful part and with the Play-Doh, isn't failure a big part of learning? If you do it wrong, you learn what you did wrong.
I have to confess, I'd have to ask you how you define failure. We talk a lot about failure in design, and I don't believe that most things people call failure is failure. I think if you give up and walk away from it, but those of us who grew up in English class doing 5-paragraph essays, we're used to being told you have to do revisions. And for some reason, we've gotten to the point in math and science that we grade the test right or wrong. And I try to think of it more like writing that essay, that there's not a answer at once and you're done, but you iterate. You try things. Some work better than others. I've tried to expunge the F word, though, from my talking about it.
Barbara, you were shaking your head on that.
Oh, well, it does depend on how you define it. But failure is just so valuable if you embrace it and just keep moving ahead and learning from it. It's actually, if you embrace it, it's kind of cool.
So you're going to continue with your squishy Anne-Marie?
We are going to continue with our squishy circuits, yeah. And other things of that ilk.
All right, we'll watch out for more of that stuff. Anne-Marie Thomas is Associate Professor of Engineering at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul and author of the upcoming book, Making Makers, Kids' Tools and the Future of Innovation. And if you want the recipe for the squishy circuits, it's on our website at sciencefriday.com/squishycircuits. Thank you for joining us, Anne-Marie.
Thank you very much.
I'm here with Barbara Oakley and Ben Carey. Barbara is the author of A Mind for Numbers, a professor of engineering at Oakland University in Rochester. Ben Carey is the author of How We Learn and a science reporter at the New York Times. And if you want to read excerpts of their book, from their books, we have them both up there at sciencefriday.com/learning. What did you think? That was just an interesting new technique for learning stuff.
It's a perfect example of the brilliant, fun kinds of things that can make STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, really as exciting as it actually is. So I just love that work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the early learning research was done in these problem solvings in these places that look like your grandfather's garage with ropes and wrenches and so on, and building stuff and solving problems that way. And this feels like a refreshing return to that. I mean, you know, we shouldn't be sort of sitting there trying to live up to an ideal of how we should learn. We should experiment with things.
I was wondering this earlier today as I thought about this. Is there a difference between learning something like a language, something that you have to memorize? Is there something going on in your brain that's different than trying to solve a problem? Are we using different parts? Do we have to think differently? Do we need to take a different break? Should we play? Should we make a game out of it? You know, that's what
I think so. I mean, I you know, at least in the techniques I describe in the book, I do divide them between retention tools, you know, for language, you know, facts, figures, faces, and so on, and comprehension ones. And the retention tools are things like splitting up your study time according to a schedule that's useful and it's well-timed. Self-testing. Barbara and I have talked about that. Moving around, changing places, and so on. Using restlessness in your favor. Those are all good retention tools that may eventually also add to comprehension. Comprehension is the sort of thing we talked about with problem solving. Being able to take a break and time a break just to write the right time. Mm-hmm. And also sleep helps. You know, we talked about that a little bit, but sleep, particularly the second half of the night, REM-rich sleep, is extremely helpful for comprehension kind of learning.
Barbara?
Well, I would say that this brings up a very interesting point in that people often think that understanding is the be-all and end-all in math and science. And actually, it bears a lot in common with learning languages in that when you're trying to learn something in math and science, when you understand it, that is not enough because you can forget it easily. How many times have students come up to me and said, you know, I understood it when you said it in class.
But when I got home, I just forgot it.
Yeah, and then when you came back for the test, you really forgot it. So practice and repetition, kind of similar to what you do when you're learning a language, is actually also important in enhancing your understanding of whatever you're learning.
Mm-hmm. That's 844-724-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Philip in Pensacola, Florida. Hi, Philip. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi there.
I have just a comment on retention for the panel, too, if they know anything about this. But in the military, I work in special forces, and it's almost encouraged any time when you're learning either dive school or jumping or medical, any of that stuff, that you can just stop, you know, go to the back of the room, do some push-ups if you're falling asleep, and it really helps re-vector your focus on what you're trying to learn and retain. And I noticed that I've went to other universities, and you don't have that option there. It's hard to sit through one of those micro-burst class where you're sitting for 4 hours or, you know, with 10-minute breaks, and you would just be looked. People would think you're crazy if you stop and do some push-ups or walk to the back of the classroom. They almost find it insulting. But I wanted to just mention that it does help with retention.
Hmm. And they encouraged you to do that.
Yeah, at any point, it's not insulting to the instructors if you get up and you go to the back and you do some push-ups and maybe stay standing up the whole time or go back to your seat. But I think in a traditional classroom, some instructors definitely have given me the eye, like, you know, what are you doing getting up in the middle of my lecture?
future.
Wow, it's a great suggestion. Myra Flato, this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Barbara, Ben, what do you think of that?
Well, having been in the military myself, I still remember one time this smart aleck, he was dropping into the water. And before he dropped, he requested permission to drop, sir. And then he sang a song. He sang, "I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay." Boy, when he got out of the water, the drill sergeant just had him doing push-ups like crazy. But the thing is, doing push-ups and doing this kind of thing, it actually does. It refreshes your brain. It takes you into a different place. And, of course, we know that exercise really does enhance your ability to learn.
Yeah, I mean, I think you put yourself in motion, it can really help. I mean, you know, I don't know about you. I remember studying and getting a basketball and just standing out in the driveway and 1, 2, 3, 4, yeah. Repeating 1, 2, 3, 4, or a soccer ball or something like that, and it just loosened everything up. It's absolutely great.
You know, yeah. If I would go out jogging or just taking a long walk and I have a song playing in my head, all of a sudden things pop in, you know? That's how you do that. That's how I repair that crack in the caulking when I couldn't figure out how to do it before, you know? It's sort of, and I remember reading essays or research papers that say if you want to remember something or figure out a problem, drive or go take a shower or something where the sound in the background is just constant, right? And it sort of soothes you from what you're thinking about.
Well, as creativity experts have said, the bed, the bath, and the bus are some of the best ways to get into that sort of relaxed and resting states that allow you to think more creatively about things.
Yeah, so that goes along with what you were saying before, take a break.
Right. Right.
Is there an optimal amount of time to sit there and study? Has anybody studied that?
I don't think so.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what about cramming for a test? Does that work?
Well, cramming works. You remember for the test, just as long as the test isn't delayed for a couple of days. It works for a small amount of time. It's like stuffing a cheap suitcase. You know, it holds for a while and then everything falls out. Spaced study, which we've mentioned before, keeps it in there for a lot longer. So cramming is a good short-term strategy. I mean, I don't know about you. I remember walking out of exams, and I mean, not only don't you remember anything, you barely know how to get home.
Right.
Now you're sitting there. Like
right.
It's,
right.
So that's what cramming does. I mean,
mm-hmm. So some take-home messages. One would be repeat to yourself what you're trying to learn. And get as many senses involved as you can?
Absolutely. That really helps to do something like that. And I have to bring up another idea, and that is we're talking about cramming and the importance of spacing mm-hmm. things out, but also when procrastination is a very big deal when you're learning. And people don't understand, but a lot of times if you look at something you really don't like let's say you don't like studying math, you'll look at the book and then the pain centers in your brain actually activate. And so that's why you do something to eliminate that pain, which is you switch your attention. So there's two ways to handle procrastination. You can work through it, takes a few, 20 mm-hmm. minutes or so, or you can switch your attention. So a lot of people just switch attention. If you can trick your brain, though, and that's just by using the Pomodoro technique, and that is just set a timer for 25 minutes and then work intently for 25 minutes. And what that does is it gets you into the flow of a flow of what you're doing without focusing on the task, which, remember, lights up those pain centers.
Well, that's a great technique to take with us. Thank you very much, both of you being with us today. Barbara Oakley, author of A Mind for Numbers, professor of engineering at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. Benedict Carey, author of How We Learn, science reporter at the New York Times. And as I say, we have excerpts from both of the books at sciencefriday.com/learning.